welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Marianne Wagner, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Today I am delighted to have on our program Dr. Carrie Garrison-Laney. Carrie is a tsunami hazard specialist with Washington Sea Grant and liaison to the National Center for Tsunami Research at NOAA in Seattle. She has researched tsunami deposits in California and the Salish Sea. Her work includes identifying paleo tsunami deposits and determining their age using carbon dating. She runs tsunami simulations also to study how past tsunamis would have inundated coastal areas. Carrie teaches and participates in a variety of outreach activities, including Washington's Tsunami Roadshow. Welcome, Carrie.
Thanks, Marianne. It's great to be here.
It seems like we've been hearing a lot more about tsunamis over the past several years. Why is that?
Well, we've always had tsunamis, but tsunami science and tsunami awareness, especially in North America, really exploded after the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and the 2011 Japanese tsunami. These really increased interest, and they were so well photographed and filmed that it gave us, I think, a much clearer picture of what we may be in for in the future. And so a lot of the science really took off in order to understand what past tsunami histories were for certain areas, and also to know what we might expect in the future.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I think anyone who watched any of the videos, especially from 2011 Japan, who lives in a coastal area along Washington's coast, for instance, probably didn't have any trouble imagining what would that be like if that happened here. And I think in some ways, even though there had been some tsunami awareness, I think in ways that was a real wake-up call for coastal residents and emergency managers and planners to really put some serious effort into being prepared for when this will happen on our shoreline.
Carrie, can you tell us what exactly is a tsunami?
That's a great question. A tsunami is a wave, but it's very different from the kinds of waves we see generated by wind. A tsunami is formed when the entire water column is displaced, typically by something that happens down on the seabed. So you can have an earthquake that suddenly displaces a large mass of seabed, and that pushes up the water above it, and that water flows out in all directions and continues to flow, moving very rapidly in deep water. And then as it gets to shallower water, slows down a bit, moving faster. It's still moving quite fast, but it slows down. And that slowing of the speed actually makes the height of the wave get taller. So by the time it reaches a coastal area, you can get some pretty spectacular all waves.
Well, you also mentioned that you're studying paleo tsunami. Can you explain what that is and how on earth do you study those?
A paleo tsunami is basically just a term we use to describe a tsunami that we know happened but may not have been observed. And the only way we know it happened is because of the geologic evidence it leaves behind. And specifically, that would be a tsunami deposit.
Okay. And where can we find geologic evidence of paleo tsunamis in Washington State?
Well, the setting that is most likely to preserve a tsunami deposit is an intertidal marsh or sometimes a low-lying lake that's near the coastline. And we find them in some of the estuaries in southwest Washington around Wilbur Bay and Grays Harbor. And there are also tidal marshes in some of the bays along the Strait of Juan de Fuca, like Discovery Bay and Port Townsend Bay. where we find tsunami deposits in the tidal marshes. And also, we've found tsunami deposits in some of the tidal marshes around Puget Sound.
So you say that you find these tsunami deposits. What exactly are you looking for when you're seeking evidence of these ancient tsunamis?
Good question. What we look for in a sequence of tidal marsh sediments is something that looks unusual, something that's different from what I would call the business as usual sediments that accumulate in a tidal marsh. And usually what we see is a very widespread, fairly uniform thickness layer of sand or sometimes silt. And if that is distributed over a marsh, it's pretty indicative that some kind of an unusual event happened that brought all that sediment in and deposited it.
Where do these paleotsunamis actually come from, though?
Well, in Washington State, we are actually pretty rich in potential tsunami sources. We have offshore of Washington State, out in the Pacific, we have the Cascadia subduction zone, which is our probably most dangerous tsunami source. And every few hundred years, we get a very large earthquake that deforms the seabed and has the potential to generate a large tsunami. We know the last time that happened along the Cascadia subduction zone was in the year 1700, so 320 years ago now. But we also can generate tsunamis on some of the many shallow faults that crisscross Washington State. One example of that is the Seattle Fault, which runs right through the city of Seattle, but there's many others, and they all have the potential to generate their own tsunamis. We also can have tsunamis generated from landslides, either landslides where material is sliding down into water and displacing it, or you can also have submarine landslides that happen underwater and also displace water. And these landslides can happen during earthquakes, but we also know from living in this area, this is a very landslide-prone area, and they can happen without earthquakes as well. And then finally, well, not finally, because there are other sources, including volcanic eruptions and asteroid impacts, which we probably don't need to be concerned about. But then the other source is tsunamis that are generated on other subduction zones around the Pacific, such as Japan or Chile or Alaska, all have the potential to send tsunamis up to the coast of Washington and even into the Strait and the Sound.
Your research indicates that Cascadia tsunamis may also be dangerous along the Strait and in parts of Puget Sound, which is really surprising. What do you mean by Cascadia tsunamis, and tell us what we might expect from tsunamis that travel into the Strait from the Pacific?
That's a great question, Marianne. Cascadia tsunamis, what I mean by that, are tsunamis that are generated offshore in the Pacific Ocean on the seabed along the Cascadia subduction zone. That's really the tsunami source that we consider the most dangerous for Washington coastlines. Now, the difference between what that looks like on the Strait or in the Sound compared to the coastline along the Pacific coast is the wave heights will not be as high once the tsunami's in the along the Strait or down into the Sound. And so we're not as worried about really tall waves washing over communities in the Strait and the Sound. But there are going to be some places that do experience that inundation, tsunami water flowing up onto places that are usually dry. These are going to be the low-lying communities and also places that are at the end of a waterway. It's not going to affect every place equally, but some areas will probably have some inundation if we have a Cascadia tsunami. Inundation is not really the primary hazard in places along the Strait and down in the Sound. The hazard we're most concerned about are the dangerous currents that will get generated by the tsunami as it flows in and bounces off all the different land masses. And in our simulations, we find that dangerous currents can persist for over 12 hours. These are the things that we need to be most concerned about in the inner coast waterways.
You mentioned volcanoes being a source for tsunamis. Can you tell us what that might look like? That's very interesting.
We don't have to be concerned about our cascade volcanoes potentially generating tsunamis because they're so far inland. But there are places in the world where volcanoes are surrounded by seawater, and when they have eruptions, they can have part of the volcano can collapse and displace a bunch of water. We also have some volcanic eruptions at our mid-ocean ridge offshore that suppose may have the potential to generate some kind of a tsunami, but I don't think that's ever been documented as a tsunami source. So overall, I'd say we don't need to worry about volcanic sources here.
If you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. And I am Marianne Wagner, today's host of Coastal Cafe. And we're speaking with Dr. Carrie Garrison-Laney about tsunamis in the Northwest. So Carrie, you do a gig every year called the Tsunami Roadshow that is intended as a public service to coastal communities, educating them about their tsunami hazards and how to prepare. So who goes on these tours with you?
The Tsunami Roadshow is organized and run by the Washington Emergency Management Division. And partners that are part of the tour include people from the Washington Geological Survey at the Department of Natural Resources, people from the National Weather Service, which is in charge of tsunami warnings, and also myself from Washington Sea Grant.
And where does the Tsunami Roadshow travel to?
The Tsunami Roadshow used to focus solely on Pacific Coast locations and also locations along the Straits. So in the past, we've gone places like Ilocos and Aberdeen and Ocean Shores and also Port Angeles and Port Townsend. We are going to have another roadshow that focuses on what we call the inner coast. And we had to do that one as a webinar this year. But in the future, when we're able to do these live in person, we will likely be going places like Bellingham, Seattle, Tacoma, places where there's a lot more coastal infrastructure, ports, ferries, marinas, things like that, where decision makers in charge of all those facilities will need to have some idea of how they should respond when they hear that a tsunami is on the way.
Didn't one town, after learning about their tsunami hazards, actually build an evacuation tower on top of a school building? And where was that?
Yes, that's right. The Ocosta Elementary School in the Westport School District has the only tsunami evacuation structure in North America. It was finished in 2016. And it was paid for when voters approved a bond to pay for it. The school actually needed to do some renovations to their gymnasium, and they were able to get the voters to approve an extra 10% of the construction cost to build an evacuation platform on top of the gymnasium that can hold 400 people and also have supplies to sustain those people for a period of time. And this was in response to really, I think part of it is because of what people had seen in the years previous, what tsunamis look like in other places. And also the fact that in many parts of Southwest Washington, there just isn't enough time to get to high ground. And so a lot of communities are looking at potentially being completely overrun by a wave. And this was a way to ensure that people that are in that, all the children that go to the elementary school and also the middle school, which is right next to it, and people in the community have a safe place to go.
Is this the first one that you've heard of? I mean, is this like a model for others to follow?
It's the first structure built in North America, and there are more structures that are either have been approved and are funded. There's one that's going to be built on the Shoalwater Bay Reservation, and others, I think other communities are looking to see if they can find the funding to build these as well. They are expensive, and some of them are, some of those communities may not have a lot of discretionary funds for these types of structures. But I personally would like to see more of these be built because they can really be a lifeline in some places.
Especially those low-lying communities in the western Washington coastal area. Sounds like a great idea. And what are ways individual people on the coast can prepare?
That is a really good question. I think it's really important for people who live or work or recreate in tsunami inundation zones to have a plan. They need to find out if they are in an inundation zone. They need to know what they're going to do if they get a warning that a tsunami is on the way. And warnings can come in different forms. There can be a natural warning, which would be very strong shaking from an earthquake. That's a very good warning that a tsunami might be on the way. Or you may get an electronic warning, an emergency alert on your phone, or maybe from social media or news, or if you have a NOAA weather radio, you may get a warning. Another warning you might get is a tsunami siren going off. But sirens are probably only going to go off when we're going to get a tsunami from far away. Let's say Alaska had a big earthquake and tsunami and it was on the way. Then the sirens would go off in the coastal areas. If we have a big earthquake on Cascadia, there's a chance that the sirens won't actually be activated if there's any damage to them or if there's issues with power. And also, it takes time to initiate that siren warning. And on the coast, you feel a big, strong earthquake. You really don't have time to wait around for the siren. In addition to knowing what to do, you also need to follow instructions of emergency managers. If there's an evacuation route, you need to know about it. And then also, you need to have some supplies. If your home or business is in the inundation zone, you really need to be able to grab your supplies and get out and expect to not be able to get back into those areas for at least maybe 12 to 24 hours.
Well, thank you for that guidance. Are most coastal towns in Washington ready to evacuate in the event of a tsunami?
Well, I think there are some that are better prepared than others. And right now, the state of Washington is working on developing new inundation maps to cover the entire coast. Some areas have already gotten their new maps, and some are upcoming. And that's the really great work that's done by Washington Geological Survey. They also put out evacuation maps that identify which routes to travel and where to assemble. And these are made in collaboration with local emergency managers. So they're very good, and it's very important to know where you're supposed to go if you have to evacuate and what is considered the safest way to get there.
Well, thanks, Carrie. And just for fun, let's do a true or false quiz and test you on your tsunami knowledge. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, a tsunami is one wave and then it's over. True or false?
False. We know that tsunamis come in many, many waves, which can continue for hours after the first initial wave.
Oh, Okay, and the first wave is always the largest. True or false?
That is also false. Sometimes the first wave is not the largest. In fact, in parts of Japan in 2011, the fourth wave was the largest in some areas.
Okay. If you feel a big earthquake, you should move away from the shoreline. True or false?
Oh, I think I might have given that one away already. But the answer to that is true. If you are near a body of water and you feel a big earthquake, you need to get to high ground.
Okay. You don't need to worry about tsunamis when you're near a lake. True or false?
False. You do need to worry about tsunamis anytime you're near a large body of water if you feel strong shaking. We have a lake in Washington, Lake Crescent, which is west of Port Angeles, that has geologic record of producing some pretty spectacular tsunamis from a rock sliding into the water during earthquakes.
You can outrun a tsunami. True or false?
For most of us, that's false. If you are a world-class sprinter, you may be able to, but tsunami waves travel around 30 miles per hour. So it would be, most of us are going to have to assume that we cannot outrun a tsunami.
If no high ground is nearby, it is best to climb a tree. True or false?
If you truly had no other option, climbing a big tree might save your life, but it's not a guarantee. A better option would be to find a building with a substantial concrete foundation.
Well, thank you. I would say, Carrie, that you get an A. Well done.
Thank you.
So just to wrap up, I would say that, Carrie, you do not have a typical 9-to-5 job, do you? And when you are out in the field working, what are the tools that you bring with you, and what exactly are you doing? You're not sitting at a desk necessarily.
That's true. When I do field work, I usually come home covered in mud from head to toe. My tools include a coring device so I can investigate what's going on in the subsurface of a marsh, and also shovels and materials to collect samples, and a camera. It's a pretty low-cost field operation, and it's all really good fun, and get to be in some new places that seem very peaceful but have some secrets underneath the surface.
Ah, some secrets indeed. Well, thank you, Carrie, for telling us about coastal hazards, including past tsunamis in our region, and what they can tell us about our future.
Thank you, Marianne. I really enjoyed being on the show and talking to you.
This is Marianne Wagner, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastline. I'd like to thank our station manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And a shout out to the local Native American band, Kuiks, for sharing their music with us at the open and close of this program. And thank you for listening, and have a good day. Ingen ani, ha tu asibu ha.